Thanks for tuning into the podcast. Before we start the show, I want to let you know something. My latest novel, Personal Fable, is free for the next few days. So if you're hearing this ad, it's currently free if you're a Kindle user. So just look it up on your Kindle. If you don't have a Kindle, you can even get one of those for free by getting the free Kindle app on your phone. And then head over, get Personal Fable, have a read, and if you love it, leave a review. And I hope you love the story. Now, let's get on with the podcast. P.S. The promotion runs the 11th, 12th, and 13th of March. Welcome back to The Hemingway List, a podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today's episode is brought to you by a bowl of minestrone soup, which is sitting right in front of me on my desk, but it's too hot to eat, so I need to wait about 10 minutes anyway. So I won't be eating it on the podcast. Rest assured. We're talking about Part 5, Chapter 10 of Anna Karenina. How will this lot get along? Referring to Vronsky and Anna visiting this famous artist. Simply Productive had some unrelated things. Number one, from yesterday, I really like the idea of an obscured image of Vronsky. Why is it as soon as I start podcasting, I get a frog in my throat? Why? Obscured image of Vronsky, sorry. It's almost like he is a literary window through which we view Anna. And keep in mind that in literary fiction, windows, mirrors, and things of that nature will fundamentally distort the trueness or the realness of the image you're seeing. This is imitated in cinema all the time. Probably the most useful course I had in my English degree was the one where I learned about Philip K. Dick and how effectively he uses the theme of an obscured image through his novels. But as you said, Ander, that he is obscured as an image, it struck me that this may very well be the genius of Anna Karenina. Anna is distorted because of Vronsky. In Karenin, she is perfectly fine, contented, to be sure, but she would survive just fine. Discontented, sorry, to be sure, but she would survive just fine. But Vronsky, since he isn't really a solid character or personality, offers, well, a bit of everything. He's got the artistry, he's got the jockey side, his military prowess, his conversational charm, and of course his very heightened emotions. And what could look more appealing to a housewife? Maybe I should give more credit to Vronsky after all. 2 days ago, I had been sorely tempted to judge Vronsky, even deigning to pick up a brush. He isn't an artist, or is he? Maybe I'm being too harsh, but of course I am an artist, and it's an innate thing that a tremendous number of people simply don't have. I think everyone here understands what I mean, right? It's not arrogance, it's just a difference in personality at a base level, something that can only be known, not taught. When you paint, you need to imbue something in it, something in English literature we would call the real. Something that makes the Mona Lisa unique from any attempt at reproduction. Something that causes a canvas covered with varying shades of blue and nothing else to make you cry. Does Vronsky really seem like he has this capacity, or have I missed something? I wouldn't say that he's not suave or gentlemanly and able to stand in high society with ease. I just mean that he isn't a soulful man. He is hedonistic, not driven by hedonism of the soul, which is also a thing, but hedonism of the flesh. He is already getting bored with Anna, just as he did with Kitty. This painting thing is just another dalliance that I feel will end as soon as he's bored. All sounds like about right. Vronsky doesn't seem to have the artistic spirit, but if he's painting and people like what he paints, then I suppose he's an artist, you know? Like a working artist kind of a career artist can often have a different temperament than a like integrity stricken passionate artist, but I still rate them all the same. Number two, although, you know, if he's completely dispassionate about it, then that does kind of remove something from the paintings, but it kind of remains to be seen whether he's passionate about it or not. Number two, unrelated things. So help me if they devastate that lovely artist, I will punch my fist through time and existence itself and give Vronsky a decent licking. But they will. They will be little jerks. number three, unrelated thing. I am also with I Am Norwegian. As per usual, I usually agree with him. I do yet again. I love the commentary on Wallace. Wallace definitely points out something valid. Andor, I quite like and respect you. Thank you. I like and respect you too. And think of you as a friend. Thank you. I think of you as a friend. But the primary difference between us is that I have a lot of respect for religion, and it's fairly evident. Yeah, I don't really, do I? Yeah, I have been pretty disrespectful towards religion in this podcast, so I can say fair call. And it's fairly evident in your comments that it leaves you befuddled. Nah, I don't think I'm confused by it. I'm confused that people buy into it, but it's not like I don't understand it. So I don't think you're right there. In fact, I think that's kind of the defense that religious people use of like, oh, you don't believe this, like you think this is untrue. Oh, you must not just understand it. You must be confused, or you mustn't be as smart as I am, you know, that kind of thing. It's very, I don't know. I don't think it's the right way to think of it. I mean, we all know that only the smartest people are religious. Unfortunately, there is no way to pass on its value at this point, in my estimation. I understand the value of it too. I think it's extremely valuable, and I don't know, I actually quite like it, to be frank. Like, I like Christian symbolism, I love the stories, I love the myths. I just don't believe it. I believe its importance, but I just don't, it's just not true. Like, it's fiction. That's my only point. But it's not bad. People get crazy about it, which is insane, but I don't understand it. There's no way to pass on its value at this point. I already understand its value, in my estimation, because our world does not value religion anymore. It used to, but the overarching belief is one of atheism is in any westernized society, and a total rejection of religion and all that comes along with it is valued. And of course, I certainly agree with that the militant evil church and state corporatized religions and absolutely meant to be stopped, as they infringe on rights and cause nothing but hatred. There is tremendous beauty in religion as an ideological ideal, and especially in some of its more common traditions, like its liturgical calendar. The liturgical calendar is a way of marking time in seasons that match certain moods. So right now is the season of Advent, which is characterized by its loud jingle bells, obnoxious Christmas music by Mariah Carey in malls, loud proclamations about how joyous we are, and oh wait, no, that's just what it's become with time. In all honesty, Advent is a season of quiet, patient anticipation. It's actually a time of fasting and deprivation, so you can easily relish the feeling of oncoming delight, like pre-enjoying something and waiting on the edge of your seat for all the wait to be over. It's a feeling like you get 3 weeks to vacation, but a little more solemn. That's a beautiful thing. I always know that in April I have a season for being sad during Lent. I have a time where I'm allowed to be sorrowful. There is a lot to mourn in life as well, but instead of being heart-wrenching, it is a time of a remembrance, of honouring the past, and of looking forward to the changes ahead. These things are not valued anymore. We are expected to always be happy, to aim for happiness, and to never have bad days. And so, when a bad mood does strike, usually it's devastating instead of being manageable. It's so easy to belittle things, truly it is. Anyone learning something for the first time, or anyone who values tradition and pomp and circumstances is made fun of. I mourn this. I actually do too, and I kind of resent being lumped in with that because I don't believe in God. Like, I'm not belittling the religion itself. I mean, I actually have, so that's fair to say, but I don't know. I like tradition. I like Christian values. I don't know. Anyway. But yeah, I don't know. Like, religion, talking about, this is why I don't like to talk about religion, because it just drives a wedge between people. And I like you, so let's not wedge ourselves apart. I Am Norwegian says, regarding the painting and imbuing something into it, I think you're right, but at the highest level, anyone can paint competently too if they give it time and effort. Tolstoy does mention that Vronsky does not paint from the soul. He catches on quickly, but he imitates others. But there are those that somehow manage to fill their paintings with impossible depth, and who manage to capture the soul of the era. Here's a video on that subject. Yep, I'm not going to click on that video. but it is an interesting topic. I don't know. Like, what about that quote where they're like, the best artists are just those who are best at hiding their sources? Like, every artist is doing an impression of another artist and probably improving on it if they can. But then it's the ones who can obscure those sources and be like, no, no, I'm doing something new. I'm a genius. But they're just the ones who are the best at obscuring their whoever they're mimicking. And I reckon there's like a degree of truth in that. I Am Norwegian says, I agree with you, Ander. It is very easy to belittle things. It's kind of fun, too. There was nothing that got Tekrivik going more like a cynical character making fun of people or for believing in something, either. I seem to remember David Foster Wallace continuing that in the future it would be rebellious to have genuine beliefs, to look towards tradition with respect, and all of those things that we had lost. Some decades later, you had Jordan Peterson explode in popularity, reviving an interest in religion and a respect for tradition in young people, and the weirdest thing is that following these things are actually rebellious and will get you labelled as something of a simpleton or a useful stooge if you let it slip in hip company that you buy into it. Yeah, it's so true. It's like almost like punk rock now to be like, to like Jordan Peterson. Maybe it's worth reading Foster Wallace guy. I have heard a ton about Infinite Jest. I really enjoyed Tolstoy's description of the artist's process. I'm actually looking forward to the War and Peace beekeeping chapter I've heard so much about. That is a bad chapter. I stand by that. It's a lot of people's favourite chapter in the whole book, and for me it was like standout worst. Definitely a dividing one, that one. Alright, that's the talk. That's the talk. I'm trying to get through this quick because this soup smells so good. If only you could smell a podcast. It's probably for the best with the whole slipper thing. Alright, chapter 11 goes like this. On entering his studio. Oh, here we go. We're entering the studio. On entering his studio, the artist again cast a glance at his visitors and took note of Vronsky's face, especially his jaw. Although his artistic perceptions never slept, and although he was growing more and more excited as the moment approached when his picture was to be criticized, he quickly and shrewdly, from imperceptible data, formed his opinion of these three persons. Of Golinishev, he thought, that one is a Russian who lives here. Mikhailov did not remember his name, or where he had seen him, or what they had talked about. He remembered only his face, as he remembered every face he had ever seen, but he also remembered that it was one of the faces he had mentally put aside with the enormous class of falsely important faces. Faces lacking expression. A mass of hair and a very open forehead gave a superficial significance to that face, which had an insignificant, childish, restless expression concentrated in the narrow bridge of his nose. Vronsky and Anna, according to Mikhailov's conception, were in all probability distinguished wealthy Russians, who, like all these wealthy Russians, comprehend nothing of art but pretended to be amateurs and critics. Probably they've seen all the antiquities and are now going the round of the modern painters, the German quack and the stupid English pre-Raphaelite. And to complete the series, have come to see me too, he thought. Well, he knew the dilettante's way of examining the studios of modern artists, the cleverer they were, the worse they were, with the one purpose of being able to say afterwards that art had deteriorated and that the more modern art one sees, the more evident it becomes that the old masters were inimitable. He expected all this, saw it in their faces, in the careless indifference with which they talked among themselves, looked at the lay figures and busts, and unconcernedly walked about while waiting for him to uncover his picture. But in spite of all this, as he turned over his studies, pulled up the blinds, and withdrew the sheet from his picture, he felt very excited, all the more so because, though he regarded distinguished and wealthy Russians as mostly beasts and fools, Vronsky and especially Anna pleased him. "There," he said, stepping aside with his loose gait and pointing to the picture, "this is Pilates' Admonition, Matthew chapter 27. He went on, conscious that his lips were beginning to tremble with excitement, and he stepped behind the visitors. During the few moments that they were silently gazing at it, Mikhailov also regarded it with the indifferent eye of a stranger. In those few moments he believed in advance that the highest and justest of criticisms was going to be pronounced by these very visitors whom he had so despised a moment before. He forgot all that he had thought of his picture during the 3 years that he had worked at it, forgot all its merits, which he had not doubted, and saw it from the fresh point of view of an indifferent stranger, and he saw nothing good in it. He saw in the foreground Pilate's vexed face and Christ's calm one, and behind them the faces of Pilate's servant and of John, watching what was taking place, each of those faces that with so much searching, so many faults and corrections he had evolved with its own character, each representing so much pain and pleasure, and all of them so often placed and replaced to obtain harmony, all the shades of colour and tone elaborated with such effort, all this regarded as a whole from those others' point of view, now seemed trivialities a thousand times repeated. The face that was most dear to him, that of Christ, the centre of the picture, which had so enraptured him when he first discovered it, now regarded from the other standpoint, seemed quite worthless. He saw a well-painted and not even that for the he saw a well-painted and not even that, for he detected a multitude of errors, repetition of those innumerable Christs, Titians, Raphaels, Rubens, with the same warriors and the same Pilates. It was trivial, poor, old, and even badly painted, weak and lacking harmony. They would be in the right when they began to say falsely polite things in the presence of the artist, and to pity and laugh at him behind his back. The silence grew too unbearable, though it had not lasted more than a minute. To break it and to appear calm, he made an effort to address Golenishev. "I think I have had the pleasure of meeting you," he said, glancing uneasily now at Anna and now at Vronsky in order not to lose any detail of their expressions. "Of course, we first met at Rossi's. Don't you remember that evening when the Italian lady recited the new Rachel?" began Golenishev glibly, turning away from the picture to the artist without the slightest regret. Noticing, however, that Mikhailov was waiting to hear his criticism of the picture, he said, "Your picture has progressed very much since I last saw it, and now, as then, I am specially struck by the figure of Pilate. One can so well understand that man, a kind, first-rate fellow, but an official to his very backbone, who does not know what he is doing. But it seems to me..." The whole of Mikhailov's mobile face suddenly lighted up. His eyes brightened, he wanted to speak, but was too agitated, and pretended to cough instead. Little as he valued Golenishev's capacity to understand art, unimportant as was his remark about the truth of Pilate's official expression, what was important remained unmentioned, and offensive as was this trivial, it might have seemed to him, remark before anything he had said about what was most important, Mikhailov was delighted with it. His opinion of that figure was the same. The fact that his opinion was but one of a million of other opinions, which, as Mikhailov well knew, would all have been just, did not, for him, detract from the importance of Golenishev's remark. He took a liking to Golenishev because of that remark, and his depression changed suddenly into delight. In an instant, his whole picture became alive before his eyes with the inexpressible complexity of everything that lives. He wished to say that it was just so that he understood Pilate, but his trembling lips would not obey him, and he was unable to speak. Vronsky and Anna were talking in their hushed voice, in which, partly not to offend the artist, and partly not to utter aloud a stupid remark, such as is so easily made when speaking about art, people generally talk at picture exhibitions. Mikhailov thought that on them, too, the picture had created an impression, and went up to them. "How wonderful Christ's expression is," said Anna. That expression pleased her more than all else she saw, and she felt that it was the centre of the picture, and that therefore praise of it would be agreeable to the artist. One sees he is sorry for Pilate. This too was one of a million just remarks which might have been made with reference to his picture and the figure of Christ. She said he was sorry for Pilate. In Christ's expression there should be pity, because there was love in it, a peace not of this world, a readiness for death, and a knowledge of the vanity of words. Of course there was an official expression in Pilate's face, and pity in Christ's, for the former was an embodiment of carnal and the latter of spiritual life. All this and much more floated through Mikhailov's mind, and again his face shone with ecstasy. "Yes, and how well that figure is done, and what an atmosphere there is. One could walk around it," said Golenishev, showing evidently by his remark that he did not approve of the content and idea of the figure. Yes, it is wonderfully masterly. How those figures in the background stand out, that is technique, said Vronsky, addressing Golenishev and alluding to a conversation they had had about Vronsky's despair of attaining technical mastery. Yes, yes, wonderful, chimed in Golenishev and Anna. In spite of his elation, this remark about technique grated painfully on Mikhailov's heart, and glancing angrily at Vronsky, he suddenly frowned. He often heard the word technique mentioned and did not at all understand what was meant by it. He knew it meant a mechanical capacity to paint and draw, quite independent of the subject matter. He had often noticed, as now, when his picture was being praised, that technique was contrasted with inner quality, as if it were possible to paint well something that was bad. He knew that much attention and care were needed not to injure one's work when removing the wrappings that obscure the idea, and that all wrappings must be removed, but as to the art of painting, the technique, it did not exist. If the things he saw had been revealed to a little child or to his cook, they would have been able to remove the outer shell from their idea, and the most experienced and technical painter could never paint anything by means of mechanical skill alone, if the outline of the subject matter did not first reveal itself to his mind. Moreover, he saw that if technique was spoken of, then he could not be praised for it. In all he painted, and ever had painted, he saw defects that were an eyesore to him. The results of carelessness in removing the shell of the idea, which he could not now remedy without spoiling the work as a whole, and in almost all the figures and faces, he saw traces of wrappings that had not been entirely removed, and that spoilt the picture. One thing might be said, if you will allow me to make the remark, began Golenishev. Oh, I shall be very pleased, pray do, said Mikhailov with a feigned smile. It is that you have made him a man-god, and not a god-man. However, I know that you wished to do so. I could not paint a Christ whom I had not in my soul, Mikhailov rejoined gloomily. Yes, but in that case, if I may say what I think, your picture is so good that a remark of mine cannot do it any harm. Besides which, it's only my personal opinion. Yours is different. The idea itself is different. But let us take Ivanov, for example. I consider that if Christ is to be brought down to the level of an historic figure, it would be better to choose another historic theme, a fresh one, as yet untouched. But if this is the highest theme open to art, other themes can be found if one looks for them, but the fact is art won't stand discussion and argument. Yet Ivanov's picture suggests both to a believer and an unbeliever the question, is this a god or not a god, and the unity of impression is destroyed. Why so? To me it seems that for educated people such questions can no longer exist, said Mikhailov. Golenishev did not agree with this, and keeping to his first contention that unity of impression is indispensable in art, he confuted Mikhailov. The artist was perturbed, but could find nothing to say in defense of his opinion. Excuse me. All right, there we go. That's the end of the chapter. Thank you very much for listening. I will see you tomorrow.